I get a little bit nostalgic whenever I come back. I often think about how long it's been since the church here first started supporting me and the work in Boston. And I still remember it might have been the first time I'd ever preached at the church here. And I remember one of my first things I said, I'm just a nobody. And that's still something that I like to think of myself as. I'm just a nobody. At that time, I hadn't written any books. I've still not written any books. At that time, I didn't have a fancy degree or go to, you know, some sort of college for what I do. That's still the case. 5 years can change a lot of things, but it hasn't changed that. I'm still a nobody. But I appreciate all of you, because when I come here, I feel special, and I feel like you cherish me, and you cherish my wife and the work that we're doing, and so I just appreciate that so much. And so it's a blessing to be able to come and share this time of worship and be able to study together from God's Word. We're going to be looking at, that's not where I want to be, there we go. We're going to be looking at Nehemiah chapter 4 today. So please open your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah, one of my favorite books. A mentor of mine several years ago really encouraged me as a young man to adopt a book of the Bible from the Old Testament and from the New Testament. So my favorite book from the New Testament is the book of Luke. I teach that multiple times every week. I have multiple classes on Luke. And my adopted Old Testament book is the book of Nehemiah. I just can't get enough of this, so I want to share this with you all. The elders also asked me to share some details about the work in Boston. So kind of what we'll be doing today and the format to expect is we're going to spend the majority of our time looking at Nehemiah chapter 4, gleaning the principles and the lessons from here. And then I want to spend just the last several minutes kind of briefing you all about the work in Boston and perhaps even connecting the work in Boston with what we're studying and finding some parallels and some lessons for us to take from that. So I want us to consider just the scope of Nehemiah, the context of this book. Chapter 1 of Nehemiah, Nehemiah is not Jerusalem, he's not in the Promised Land, he's in a faraway city. And he receives news from his brother about the condition of God's city, Jerusalem, and the condition of God's people. And he gets bad news. Hananiah, his brother, says, the walls are in rubble, the gates are burned, and God's people are living as not conquerors, but as survivors. Now, what Hanani told Nehemiah was known by a lot of people. In fact, at this point in time, the Israelites, the Jews, had already returned back to the Promised Land, to Jerusalem, and had been there for decades. But something different happened when Nehemiah heard about this news. You see, everyone else knew about the condition of this city. But instead of doing something about it, instead of responding the way that Nehemiah does, they stepped over the rubble. Maybe it's kind of similar to us with our dirty garages or perhaps our dirty bedrooms, right? You know, we kind of, they get filthy and get dirty and, you know, after a while you just step over. You don't even think about how dirty or how much of a mess it is until someone else with a brand new set of eyes sees. And then you realize, well, this is a mess. That's what Nehemiah happened. That's what happened with Nehemiah. His response was different than any other person there. We see that he mourns, he weeps, he fasts, he prays to God, that God would open a door for him to embark on this journey and this mission to rebuild the walls. And so, in the chapter 1, he gets the blessing and the permission and the resources of the king to go back to Jerusalem. Chapter 2 tells us about that. And then when he finally gets back to Jerusalem, he has a tough job of being able to persuade a generation of people that were used to walking over the rubble to then put their hands to the work and repair the broken condition of the walls of Jerusalem. But he persuades them because of the hand of God was on him. Chapter 3 is one of my favorite chapters in the book of Nehemiah. Chapter 3 is just a long list of names. These are the names, the men and women that put their hand to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And if you were to expect, or if you were to ask you to maybe list the type of people that would be included in Nehemiah chapter 3. Maybe you would say, well, the carpenters and the craftsmen and the blacksmiths and the construction workers. And we see a few of those. But we also see ordinary men and women. We see priests. We see officials. My personal favorite, learn about the perfumers, that even they put their hands to the work. Because the work that needed to get done required every hand, no matter how qualified you were. And during this process of rebuilding the wall, they experienced discouragement. The bad guys in our story are these fellows named Sanballat and Tobiah, among others. And I want us to read just the first few chapters, first few verses of chapter 4, as we consider the discouragement and the influence of these enemies to this project. So Nehemiah chapter 4, we'll just read the first few verses. Starting in verse 1, now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish it in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones? Tobiah joins in verse 3. Now Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down. Here these men are intent upon demoralizing and discouraging these builders. And so in verse 4 and verse 5, they pray to God. They take it to God. Say, God, you know what's happening. Hold them accountable for what they say. But verse 6 is beautiful, isn't it? In spite of the discouragement, in spite of the demoralizing efforts of Sanballat and Tobiah, verse 6, so we built the wall. The whole wall was joined together to half its height. For the people had a mind to work. This is a beautiful picture of a generation of God's people that although they're being discouraged and trying and being demoralized and trying to be threatened, they persist because they have a job to do. They have a mind and an attitude to put their hands to the Lord's work. But what we see here, starting in verse 6 to the end of the rest of the chapter that we'll read in just a moment, we're going to see the most difficult part of their construction project, of their mission, was found at halfway. At the beginning, they were just fine. But at halfway, things got tough. And things became hard. Harder than they ever were before. So I want us to be able to look at some of these challenges and be able to apply them to our own lives. And then also look at the solutions and instructions that Nehemiah gives in response to the discouragements of God's people. So I want us to read starting in verse 6 through the rest of the chapter, of chapter 4 of Nehemiah. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height. For the people had a mind to work. Now, when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the walls of Jerusalem went on and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. All of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. But we prayed to our God, and because of them we set up a guard against them day and night. Thus in Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing. Yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Our enemies said, they will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. When the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, they will come against us from every place that you may turn. Then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall and exposed places. And I stationed the people and families with their swords, spears, and bows. When I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. When our enemies heard that it was known to us that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. From that day on, half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held spears, the shields and bows and breastplates, and the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall, and those who carried burdens, took their load with one hand doing the work and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeter stood near me. I said to the nobles, the officials, and to the rest of the people, "The work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall, far from one another. At whatever place you hear the trumpet, the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." So we carried on the work, with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. At that time, I also said to the people, "Let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem, so that they may be a guard for us by night and a laborer by day." So neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon, even to the water. You see, the first half of the wall was built, but there was discouragement. There were still threats, and there was still people trying to tear them down, but they persisted. But when it got halfway, things took a turn. And I want us to consider for a moment here the challenges found at halfway. The challenges found at halfway, as we're going to look at in a moment, the old something that we're doing is new feeling kind of fades off after a while. The completion of the task seems so far away and unattainable. The challenges and difficulties seem to be piling on, and when it rains, it pours. And for every overcoming of an obstacle, it seems to be replaced by three or four. Typically, that happens about halfway through a project. And so where the workers of Nehemiah found themselves, they're at the halfway point in verse 6, and they're wore down, weary, burdened, and the task feels too heavy. And I want us to consider the challenges that the generation of God's people in this chapter faced. Because I find that often in our lives, the halfway point can also be the hardest. I think about in marriage. My wife and I are not quite in the halfway mark. We've been married for a year and a half. The honeymoon phase, I guess, is still in full swing. But the halfway point in a marriage, from people I've spoken to and talked to and witnessed, can be the hardest point. After the newness kind of fades off, that's where difficulties can rise up. Think about the new habits that we as Christians try to develop, right? The New Year's resolutions, through a Bible study, perhaps we're convicted to change our lives. And there's an excitement that comes, right? I'm going to be different. I'm going to change. I'm going to overcome this. And there's excitement and there's zeal and there's passion with starting this project. But then a few weeks goes by, or maybe a few months, or even 6 months. And you get to the halfway point and you find out where your true commitment really is, right? I think about our lives as Christians. You know, I'm very blessed to work with a lot of very young Christians up in Boston. And there's an excitement and zeal that comes with a brand new Christian. We all know what that is, and we all know how that feels like. But we all know when that moment transitions, when the halfway point comes, and their determination is tested, and hardships come, usually at that halfway point. And even the building up of church. I know both the lives of Christians and also the church, we're never at a perfect halfway point. We're ever progressing, ever changing, ever trying to get to where we're going, right? But there's some point between when we're starting and when we're finishing, and that's where most of us are. That's the halfway point. So I want us to consider some of the challenges that that Nehemiah faced and his generation faced. The first challenge I want us to consider is that they faced a persistent enemy. All right. So you notice Sanballat and Tobiah in the first couple of verses of this chapter, they tried to discourage, they tried to tear down, they tried to demoralize the people. And they weren't having none of it. They prayed to God and they had a mind to work, so they didn't give up. But neither did Sanballat or Tobiah. You see, they faced a persistent enemy. Don't we also face a very persistent enemy? I was telling someone just, you know, earlier of a young man who was overcoming and seeking to overcome sexual temptation, sexual purity. And I remember him being so excited when he told me, I said no for the first time, or near the first time. I said no. I overcame. And he was so excited. We were both excited. We were rejoicing, praising God that he had said no to temptation. His response the next day when temptation came is, what? I thought I beat that. I thought I overcome. We all know that our enemy is just as persistent. We might say no one day, and the next day, and the next day, but Satan will persist. And here we see that persistence of their enemy taking a toll to the point where finally discouragement sets in. The second challenge that we see at halfway is kind of illustrated in verse 10, right? Verse 10, notice this remark. And I want you to ask yourself, is this remark accurate? The strength of the burden bearers is failing. I tend to think that's true. They weren't making that up. Yet there is much rubbish. There's a lot of work to do. That's true. And we ourselves are unable to rebuild the walls. I want to think about that for a moment. Was that statement true? I think so too. You see, when someone's perspective during the hard times is focusing upon the greatness of the work, the greatness of the task, and you look around at the resources you have to accomplish that task, and they seem few. The workers seem few. But the problem is that when the work seems great and the workers few, there's little focus upon God. The truth is, them and their own strength and their own power, you're right, you're not able to rebuild this wall. But that's oftentimes what happens when we get in our own heads, you know, and we become discouraged because we're thinking so much of our own insufficiencies instead of recognizing who the Lord is. And we're going to see Nehemiah tries to redirect them there. The third challenge that we see, and it's all connected, is these constant reminders of the risks, of the dangers, of the difficulties that are found within the land. Notice verse 11. The enemies were plotting an ambush against these people, against these builders. And in verse 12, when the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, no matter where you go, they're going to destroy you, right? Verse 12, they will come up against you every place where you may turn. I think there's a reason why that 10 times is mentioned there. Maybe the first time this threat came to them, they're like, all right, yeah, that's scary, that's hard, but I can handle that. All right, you know, the Lord will be with us. And then a couple days later, the threat was repeated again. All right, you know, we're good, we're still good, we're trusting the Lord, we'll continue to build. And the next time, and the next time, and the next time. 10 times this threat was issued against them, was repeated to them, and by the end of it, it seems like they were worn out. And they succeeded to discouragement, and to despair, and to stopping the work, or just continuing the work. So I want us to consider Nehemiah's instructions. All right, so this is the generation of people that Nehemiah has to work with here. They're discouraged. Their strength is failing. They're halfway done. It seems so long since they started, and it's going to be so long until they finish. How does Nehemiah respond to these people? I want to find the solutions found at halfway. The first solution that we see is what Nehemiah says in verse 14. He reminds them who the Lord is. When I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome. You see what Nehemiah realized that they did? They forgot how great and how awesome God is. When we do that, when we forget how great and how awesome God is, then we seem weaker and the struggles and the work that we have to do seems greater. So here, Nehemiah says, remember God. Remember how great. Remember how awesome He is. Perhaps most of you and all of us perhaps are familiar with the passage in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 21. You know, 20 and 21. Now to Him who is able to do far more abundantly beyond all the things that we could ask or think, according to the power that works within us. That's the power that God has, is far more abundantly beyond anything that we can ask or think. But the last phrase of that verse says, according to the power that works within us. The vastness of God's power that that verse is talking about is not referring to hailstorms or to mountains or to mighty waves or to the seven to the plagues in Egypt, but it's referring to the power that God intends to display through His people. But when His people forget how great and how awesome He is, then God's power will be limited through those individuals. So He's saying, remember God's power. Remember how great and awesome God is. But He also wants to remind them of something else. He reminds them what's at stake in this fight that they're in. He says, fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, how your houses. Remember what's at stake. If you lose, if we fail, this is what's at stake. This is the danger. This is the risk. You know, we hear these stories of a child that's maybe trapped underneath a car, and the mother sees this, it comes out, and actually lifts up the vehicle. You've seen these, you know, you've heard these accounts where a child's pinned underneath the car, and the mother will come and actually lift up the vehicle to rescue her little one. Amazing stories. But the thing about that I think is interesting is if you would ask that mother 5 minutes before, hey, how about you lift up that car? She would have said, no, that's impossible, I'm not even going to try. Then how come 5 minutes later, she was at the bumper of that car trying to lift it up? It was because of the risk. It was because of what was at stake. It was because of the danger of something that she loved. So many times, when we become discouraged, it's because of this, the same thing, that we need to remember what's at stake. And we'll find courage when we realize what's the danger and the risk involved if we fail in this work that we do. The next thing, and we'll just kind of run through these quicker here, they return to the work. This is in several verses, maybe verse 15. When our enemies heard of it, that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. Sometimes the best thing to do during those challenges found at halfway is just to get back to work. Just to get back to work. That's what Nehemiah encourages the people. That's what they do. Sometimes we feel like we need to be 100% mentally and internally before we can go to work. No. We need to get to work. Serve the Lord. Praise Him. Be able to assist other people. And that will help us through that. We also learned that they had to double up on their responsibilities. This is kind of interesting details that we learned that each one, as they were building with a tool in one hand, they were also carrying a sword and a weapon to defend them in the other hand. They had to double up. And so it wasn't just, you weren't able to have just one job. You had to double up. You had to have more responsibility. And we also learned that every builder went to work knowing that help would come if needed. Look at verse 19 and 20. The work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. Imagine the difference that this would make if you were a worker. Here you're working in the wall, and you hear these threats all around you that people are going to come, and they're coming to kill you to stop this project. So you're constantly looking over your shoulder, constantly being worried, thinking that I'm on my own. Then Nehemiah says, no, you're not. We'll set up these trumpets, and the moment that you see danger, you blow that trumpet, and we'll come for you. We got your back. Imagine how much courage that would give these workers. Imagine how much courage that gives us to know that we're not on our own, that a trumpet can be blown and that we can get to the work and we can have assistance and we can have protection from that. So these are all principles that I'd like for us to apply, and obviously you can kind of work on these when it comes to your own halfway points that challenges and hardships apply. I want us to spend a few moments here in the rest of the lesson talking about the work in Boston and talking about some of the halfway challenges that I'm experiencing, that the church in Boston is experiencing, and some of the solutions that we're learning from this text and applying as best as we know how. The church in Boston, just like anywhere else, has the ups and downs, and I want to be real and share with you some of the good, but also some of the discouraging and some of the hardships that we all face and where we live. One of the things that's true in Nehemiah's time is also true in Boston is that we face a persistent enemy. It's easier to start a project than it is to finish it, because the enemy that we face is a persistent one, and one that does not give up when we overcome it. And so what happens is, you know, maybe perhaps in Boston, and what's happened, you know, in Boston is that we're about 6.5 to 7 years into the work. And there was this an excitement about kind of the work in Boston because of how new it was at the very beginning. But we all know this, after, you know, a couple years, the newness kind of fades off a little bit. And when that newness fades off, then sometimes the obstacles and the challenges kind of become more visible, become more aware to the workers there. And the discouragement often comes, just like in Nehemiah's time, when we consider how much there is to do and how few there is to do it. There are 6.5 million people in the city of Boston. And currently there are 26 in the church there. 22 adult Christians in the church in Boston. So I'm not a big math guy. Maybe you guys can figure out the ratio to that. That's a lot of work. When you talk about a big project, a big work, and obviously it's not just our work, but that's a lot to do. It's a lot for us to do. And when you look at your resources to accomplish a task, just evangelistically, or even just the need for within the church even, I believe Sonia and I, you know, are one of only 6 Christians that are more than a first-generation Christian. The rest of the Christians there are all first-generation. Majority of them are all been a Christian for 2, 3, 4 years or less. So you imagine all the grounding, all the establishing that is needed. And you look around at all the needs that we have, you look around at the resources that we have, and it's easy to see that there's a discrepancy. And easy to see that we don't have enough for this. We don't have enough power, we don't have enough strength for some of these things. And that can be challenging, and that can be hard. Another challenge is when we're constantly reminded of the risks and dangers and difficulties instead of being reminded of the solution. This is something that I know all of us face in our own way. There have been some challenges in the work in Boston over the past couple years where we've had a lot of families and a lot of really good people move away from the church there. I think over just in a small sample size, the past year and a half, we've had 25 people move away. That's about half of the church. And the people that are moving away, by and large, are the more established Christians. You know, the Christians, you know, the families, the ones that have the more mature faith. And it's hard perhaps for some of us that are remaining there, when we know that some of the reasons why these people, these good people, are moving away is because Boston's a hard place to live. Because of how expensive it is there, a lot of the families have to work very hard in order to make ends meet. And they have to live maybe an hour plus outside the city just in order to be able to find housing for their families. It's a very atheistic and kind of immoral society, perhaps more so than other places. And so after several years of working in that, that gets hard. And perhaps for those that remain, every person that leaves because of the hardness, not everyone's moved because of that, but because of the hardness, then maybe it's a reminder all of us just how hard it is to live here. And we start thinking about how challenging it is, how difficult it is, and how much of a burden perhaps it is. But I want to talk about some of the solutions. some of the solutions found at Halfway. We've got to remember who the Lord is. So how do you do that? How do you remember that the Lord is great and awesome? Well, you might have a really good answer. My answer is, we just need to study the Bible a lot, right? To be able to learn who God is. And so that's what we do. We study the Bible a lot. Between like the 22 adult Christians, you know, in Boston, the ones that I know of, I think there's at least 30 to 40 individual and group community Bible studies happening throughout the week. Every week, 30 to 40 studies. Because we want to know who God is, and we want to be reminded that He is great and that He is awesome. Because when we are looking at ourselves and we see, yeah, we're not very big, and we're not very strong, and we're not very wise, and we're not very old, not very mature, then it's easy to feel hopeless. But when we remember who God is, that He is great and that He is awesome, a battle doesn't belong for us. God will fight for us. Another thing that Nehemiah does and I seek to do as well is remember what's at stake. There are certain things that when you remember this is what we're fighting for, then it puts everything else into perspective. Perhaps this is a kind of a brash comment that I made when I first moved to Boston. But when I first, or even before I moved to Boston, I was having I visited there just for a couple days to meet with the group and kind of see if it would be a good fit for me to move up to Boston. And so we had like a men's meeting in which I was speaking to the men, and men were asking me questions. The men's meeting consisted of two other guys beside myself. And I shared with them that the reason I'm moving to Boston wasn't because of them. It was because of everyone else that's not in the Lord, not part of the church there. And we can't lose focus of that, what's at stake, and what's the purpose. And certainly that might have been a brash way of saying that, and certainly our responsibilities are to our fellow Christians. When we talk about our purpose and what's at stake, the souls of men and women. And so stories like Gene remind me that everything is worth it. Gene grew up in a denomination that believed in the keeping of the Sabbath as being God's command to mankind, and also combining the Old and New Covenants. And so he began studying on his own and realizing there's a difference between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. That there is a distinction between those things. And so he began studying the Bible, looking for a pattern that God wanted him to follow in the New Testament and in the Bible. And he realized that he had to leave. Him and his wife left this church. And he'd gone to this other church because he thought, oh, it's not what I see in the Bible, but it's close enough. But after a couple months went by, no, it's not close enough. He started realizing what God called and commanded regarding worship and how God intended for us to worship with our voices and with our hearts. And so he's just looking for a church that worshiped that way. That was a good starting point, he thought. And so he made his way through God's divine providence to our Sunday assembly. And I got to speak to him. And I set up a Bible study with him 2 days later. And I said, you've been telling me that you've been studying the Bible and just trying, you know, with an open heart to see what it says and to find a pattern for what God wants from us. What have you found out? And he was able to share several things that he saw in the Bible that people weren't doing and that people were neglecting. And I sat there and I said, I see the exact same thing. I read that just the way you read that. And we kind of sat in a moment of silence. And he said, I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only one. One thing he hadn't studied and studied much was the idea of salvation and how to become saved, how to be forgiven. And so I said, Gene, I have a chore for you if you don't mind. How about you just take a notepad and read the book of Acts and make a list of all the conversion accounts in the book of Acts and write down the different components regarding salvation, regarding the forgiveness of sins. Okay. 1 week later, on the 4th of July morning, he sent me a text saying, Dan, I understand what I have to do. I need you to baptize me. And so he was baptized here in this picture. My favorite ending detail of the story is that a couple days later, or shortly thereafter, his wife asked him, "Hey, Gene, do I need to get baptized?" And so what he said is, "Well, take a notepad, read the book of Acts, take a list of all the conversion accounts and the different components with them, and let me know what you find out." And so a couple weeks later, he baptized Bree, his wife. I was out of town on at a Bible retreat, and so I had to kind of talk him about, you know, how to baptize someone. And so my wife was able to study with Bree. And they're just a beautiful couple, and they've grown so close into Sony Night Heart. They're worshiping with the group there. But you think about this, and every hardship, every discouragement, just melts away, isn't it? Everything's worth it. You know, sometimes we're trapped in our own heads, and I'm trapped in my own head thinking about all the hard things. And I think about Gene, and I think about Bree, and there's so many others, you know, and you have your people in your own head, right? It's all worth it. You remember what's at stake, and suddenly becomes so much better. Each one must return to the work. Let's put all these up here. A couple of these other solutions. That each one must return to the work. With so few workers, we can't afford here or in Boston for anyone to be on the sidelines. And that's what Nehemiah emphasized. That each one return to their own work. But also, and I've really taken this to heart, each person doubled up on their responsibility. Well, it's really this year, I'll tell you what, I have never spent a year where I've done more of the things that I don't think I'm good at and less of the things that I think I'm good at. Because that's a situation that many of us find ourselves in when we look at the needs that are around us and we make a list of the things we're good at and they don't match up. We have a choice. All of us have a choice in that situation. I can either cross my arms and say, "Yeah, that's a need, but I'm not good at that. Someone else will do it. Someone else will come along. Someone else who's better equipped, someone else who's more qualified will do that. And so I'm just going to wait. I'm just going to hold off, and I'm not comfortable with that." Or, if you've never picked up a sword before, pick up that sword. Or pick up that tool. Double up. Maybe an example of this, my wife and I are enjoying marriage very much. I think we have a strong marriage so far, as much as you can for being married for a year and a half. In the church in Boston, we are the go-to couple for marriage advice. A year and a half married, Sonia and I have 3 or 4 regular Bible studies with couples and individuals regarding their marriage. That's not right. That's not the way it should be. That's not, you know, I don't feel qualified for this. I feel like I'm working through things. I'm learning. But wow, I don't feel like I should be in that position. But if I don't, who doesn't? Who will? And there, I don't have all the wisdom that most of you all have regarding this issue. But I do know the things that God's taught me. And maybe the things that I've learned that God's taught me I can share with somebody else. I might not be qualified or may not be, you know, wise in that subject, but I can do what I can do. And I can double up my responsibilities. And this is true, I think, of many other ways. Justin Dobbs, the other evangelist there that worked with me for 5 years, him and his family left and moved about a year ago. I can't tell you how many times I've received an email with a really like deep doctrinal question. I'm just not as good at those kind of things. I'm like, "Oh, I wish Justin was here for this." But I'm here. And so I do as best I can, realizing that God's grace is sufficient for my weakness and that God can fight for us. And this final point here, I think, is extremely, extremely important. To know that when hard times come, you got backup. And that can give courage to a church like Boston, to Christians that are up there. Knowing that not only individually, you know, one another, each other in Boston, Christians there can help each other, but even to know that the Christians here in Columbus can be a blessing. That if and when we need to sound that trumpet, or I need to sound that trumpet, I need some help, I need some encouragement, to know that saints from this church, saints from this group of believers, be ready to answer the call and find the breach in the wall in order to respond to the threats. That's extremely encouraging. So, in conclusion here, I want us to consider your halfway point. The things in your life that you are at halfway on, and maybe you feel stuck. Maybe you feel like the discouragement's a little bit harder. It's keeping you from doing what you ought to do, what you want to do. The blessing in this time is that they didn't have to do it by themselves. The encouragement that Nehemiah 4 gives is that this is not a solo project. This is not something that you have to face on your own. There are brothers and sisters here within the group and elsewhere that would love to assist you and help you in that. So if there's a way that we could be of a blessing to you, then that would be something that we would want to assist in. But maybe also you look at your life and you're like, you know what, I'm not the halfway point. Because I haven't started yet. I haven't begun to build. I'm not a believer. I'm not an obedient servant of Christ. The halfway point will be hard, but the finish is beautiful and wonderful. And so I would encourage you, if you want to know about how to start living a life for Christ, how to live in obedience to Him, that you would make your need or any need that you would have known to the group here.